I'm Tom Kay, the founder of Finisterre. In 2003, I started a pioneering outdoor clothing brand born from my love of the sea and a deep belief there's a better way of making product. Driven by sustainability and innovation, as well as building a great culture, it's pushed me harder than I ever imagined. We believe that by connecting people to the sea, we can inspire people to take action and protect it. You protect what you love. We build products to enable this connection, celebrating incredible stories of the sea, and are constantly pushing the boundaries in all we do, come hell or high water.
My name's Larry Stafford, and you are listening to Hell or High Water, a Finisterre podcast exploring the depths of our oceans and the resilience of the human spirit. Hello and welcome back to the podcast. This week, we are joined by someone whose accomplishments ring pretty true to our podcast's description, a genuine case of human resilience. Bella Collins is one part of the incredible Ocean She Rows, an all-woman rowing crew, who raced 2,400 hard nautical miles across the Pacific Ocean last year in world record attempt. Setting off from San Francisco and finishing at Waikiki Harbour in Hawaii as part of the grueling, unsupported, bonkers Great Pacific Race. For those not familiar with the Great Pacific Race, I head on over to the registration website as a prospective candidate, and it reads as follows. Your team will be challenged physically, mentally, and emotionally by the greatest force on Earth, the ocean. Sleep deprivation, physical and mental fatigue, salt sores, weight loss, and the forces of nature will challenge your will to breaking point. Hailing from Essex Way, Bella now calls Cornwall home, working for the pioneering packaging experts FlexiHex. As such, Bella joined us at the workshops a couple of weeks back to rally the Finisterre troops into action in way of January morale booster, applying the theory of strength, resilience, and teamwork of an ocean row to business. As we spoke, we discussed mental fortitude required for such a race, understanding and playing to the strengths and weaknesses of the team around you, squeaky bum moments in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and the importance of remaining present in each moment of an experience like this. So without any more from me, here we go, episode 13 with Bella Collins, Eat, Sleep, Row, Repeat. I mean, you've asked me now how to surf the other day, but yeah. how was your surf the other day?
My surf was actually really fun. I don't get out very often. My aim when I moved to Cornwall was to surf once a week, but actually I've ended up being more like twice a month. But I'm not a diehard surfer. I like being out there. I like to think of myself as the happiest surfer out there because I like just being on the water and playing around, and it's not about being the best, which for me, I'm quite competitive. So when I finally accepted that I wasn't going to be the world's best surfer, but actually just accepted that I want to be the happiest out there, it changed my shift on it. And it also shifted my mind on it. And now I just go out and enjoy it and play in the whitewash, or, you know, push myself sometimes and get out to the green waves, but only if I feel comfortable doing it, and don't beat myself up if I don't.
So yeah. You haven't had the Boex brothers take you out of the reef yet?
They took me to the wave in Bristol after the Blue Earth Summit. Okay. And they were both coaching me, like, look up, do this, do that. But I liked that because, you know, I wanted to make the most of the wave. And I do want to progress, but I'm not pressurising myself to progress over any time period.
So, yeah. Me and, I remember that was back October last year, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because me and Tom, we were up there and I think we had to get back early that afternoon the next day. So the only session we could book in on was like the 8 a.m. Expert Advanced Super Plus Pro.
Yeah.
And it was the Boex boys were out. Yeah. I think they'd split. One was on the left, one was on the right.
Yeah.
Alan Stokes, some Welsh champ, and then me and Tom. And the first wave that rolled through was fine. And I've surfed it before, so I was like, okay, yeah, this will be fine. And first wave rolled through, I was like, okay, cool, that was fine. I handled that. And then the guy was just like, okay, cool, we'll put it up now. And I was like, oh my God. And they threw it up to like the bomb drop, acid drop.
Brutal.
And these guys, and so me and Tom ate concrete for the first few.
My feet ate concrete. I came out, the bottom of my sole of my foot was bleeding because I didn't catch every wave, and I got caught in the rip and had to sort of work my way across the sort of the pool and then back out again. And then, yeah, it tore off all the skin in the bottom of my feet. But I loved it. It was great. That pushed me.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, it's quite funny. We talk about more often than not, the wave comes up in probably every podcast I've done today, really? Whether it's Blue Mind or whether it's Access, all that stuff. So
yeah.
Interesting, it's already come up today. So yeah. We'll not discuss the web yet. But yeah, otherwise, it's not, like, we're not paid, it's not a plug.
Every time,
no, yeah. Really should. I'll chat to Nick. We should really get paid for that. So yeah, I mean, obviously, I became aware of Ocean Shiro's and what you'd done with The Crossing and your team and the row itself a couple of years back when I think you probably approached us for some support initially and spread the word and a bit of kit and that stuff's always really easy and and a privilege to support. And then last week you popped up again and you were doing our Sea Tuesday, first one of the year, to kind of rally the troops and talk about your amazing feat and its application actually to business. But so, and I thought, okay, I kind of grabbed you on the way out and said, oh, brilliant, let's kind of lay down a podcast. So I wanted to get in touch again and see, and see if we can go like a little bit deeper into some of those themes that you spoke of and really just kind of like go a little deeper still into the row itself.
Yeah.
That kind of incredible feat of what, last year? Last year,
so I got in on, we tried to get in on July 4th because we were going into Hawaii and we thought, how cool would that be to row in on July 4th? But we missed it by a day and came in on July 5th.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this was Ocean Row, the Pacific race.
Yep.
Now you've rowed before and you've done the Atlantic back when you were 23?
I think it was 22, yeah. So it was in 2015 going into 2016.
Yeah. And that was the Atlantic crossing.
So that was the Atlantic. So that goes from La Gomera to the Caribbean as part of the Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge.
That's right.
So we had 26 teams in that race. And somehow we came in second, pimped to the post by my brother, who came in first and 3 days ahead of us. And I was actually racing him across the Pacific as well. So that's from San Francisco to Hawaii. And he also beat me on that one by 5 days.
A sibling rivalry. I love it.
I know. To be fair, it comes across as a rivalry, but I wouldn't do it without Angus. He's my biggest supporter, and he's the person that gave me the confidence to do it in the first place. So it's actually a privilege to share an ocean with him when we do these things.
Amazing. I mean, so I became aware of, I'm very familiar with the Talisker stuff, and I probably first became aware of ocean rowing as this annual thing back when probably it was like Ben Fogel.
Yeah,
James Cracknell.
Yeah,
they did The Crossing. It was documented. That was probably my first taste of what this thing was.
Mm.
But for those who don't know, what is this self-sufficient, unsupported ocean rowing concept?
So ocean rowing became probably a very popular sport in the UK. When I say popular, I mean it's still not that many people have done it, but it's a boat, a rowing boat that is modified for the ocean. Typically, they have two cabins, so one on each side, 2 to 3 rowing positions if you're a 4-man team, and it's entirely self-sufficient. So you have to make all your water with a water-making machine, you have to take all your food, you have to learn how to run all your equipment, fix all your equipment. All your energy comes from solar panels, so that charges all your batteries, it charges your navigation systems. And you have to learn things like first aid and how to survive at sea, and if your boat breaks in half, what are you going to do? And it's amazing. There's a lot you need to learn. It's a big challenge. A lot of people are taking it on. And it's actually a privilege to be able to go out to the ocean and see things out there that nobody else gets to see, really.
Mm-hmm. So, and you did this as a team of 4.
Yes.
You've got experience with what you did back in your early 20s in the Talisker. What's the background of the other ladies who joined you
On the Pacific?
On the Pacific, yeah.
So, I was looking to do another ocean. I'd done the Atlantic, but I had this itch to do another one to prove that I wasn't a one-hit wonder, to push myself to take on responsibility in areas of this campaign that I didn't do for the Atlantic. And I was approached by a woman called P, and she had all the sponsorship for a row, but no team.
Okay.
And so she got put in touch with me through sort of connections and said, did I want to row another ocean? And it was actually quite fortuitous because I was speaking to a woman called Mary Sutherland, and we were talking about rowing an ocean. So we kind of grouped together. Mary grew up sailing with me back in Essex. She's also rowed the Atlantic before, back from New York to England, so actually here in Falmouth. So she's has this ocean experience too. And we were looking for a fourth member, and I brought in another girl that I've been brought up with, and we've had many a night sort of stargazing after a couple of glasses of wine saying, come on, Lily, I think you should row an ocean, and her umming and ahhing about it, but finally gave her the confidence to say, I know you can do this, Lily, and I would pick you as my teammate. And So she thought about it and joined the team as well. So yeah, it's the four of us, but different age group. So Lily and I are in our late 20s and P and Mary are their early 40s, all from different backgrounds, all living different parts of the country, and had to make a campaign work through COVID, which was no easy feat, but we got there.
Yeah, of course. Wow. Mm. Which is a pretty big hurdle in itself.
Yeah. I mean, one of the biggest hurdles is actually you couldn't get into America at the time that we were meant to leave. So how we were sort of had to navigate that, and P has a family, she's got two boys, how she had to leave her family earlier. We had to go via Antigua, which a lot of people sort of like, well, you got a holiday before you got to leave, but it was pretty stressful. We had to pack up our lives pretty quickly, mm-hmm. get ourselves to Antigua, spend 2 weeks there to then get into America before we could then start sort of preparing the boat and preparing ourselves to then leave. So
yeah, wow.
Yeah, it was a bit of a challenge.
Yeah, I mean, again, like, and this is the beauty of actually this podcast, but also what I do here at the business, and like speaking to folk like yourself and people who do these kind of things. And again, I've become aware the last few years in understanding these big ocean crossings, or, you know, Vendée Globe circumnavigations, that these things are quite often races in two parts. The first race is very much about even getting to the start line, financials, family, prep, equipment, sponsor. And then the second part is the race itself, and then get it to the finish line. Is that very much the case for this then?
100%. I mean, it takes a huge amount of skill and energy and dedication just to get yourself to the start line. Mm-hmm. It's a 18-month campaign to do all the preparation, and then you've got the race itself. Mm-hmm. And they do take on different skills. So you've got to pick your crewmates to think about not just who do you want at sea, mm-hmm. but who do you want to spend an 18-month campaign working with, working alongside, under very high pressure situations, because you've also got to continue with your day-to-day life. I have a full-time career. I work for a company called Flexi Hex down here in Cornwall. P is a full-time mum and got her career herself, and same with Lily and Mary. So it's about managing all of that alongside your normal life. So yeah, it's a big challenge. And like you say, it's almost two challenges in one.
Yeah. And I can't remember who I did speak to. Pete Goss, MBE. I've actually got a bit of a man crush on Pete. And he would take the solo circumnavigation any day over any kind of prep work, or that is...
Yeah, if you could tell me that I could jump on a boat tomorrow,
yeah,
and all the equipment's on it, and yeah, it's all paid for, mm-hmm. I just need to row,
yeah,
I'll do it. Okay. I'll do it in a second. I probably sort of 5 days into that, be like, why am I doing that? It's actually what happened in the Pacific. I was sort of 5 days into the Pacific, and I was hating it, and I was in pain, and I was wet, and it was miserable, and I hadn't slept, and I was barely functioning. I was like, this is a form of torture. Like, mm-hmm. why am I doing this to myself again? But actually, once you've got through that, and you've got used to being at sea and waking up at 3 a.m. to go rowing, mm-hmm. you then realise the beauty of the simple life of being on an ocean. You are just eating, sleeping, rowing, repeating. You don't have your phone buzzing. You don't have people thinking that you're, you know, on the other end of a call to their beck and call, really. And that simplicity of life from the sea is something that I crave a lot. Mm-hmm.
So what was the, I mean, are there any kind of standout differences between crossing the Atlantic to crossing the Pacific?
Yeah, I mean, several things. So the Atlantic, we managed to pick up some really good trade winds. So we mm-hmm. predominantly had weather
so
on our side.
Is obviously probably one of the, yeah.
Yeah,
the
we biggest. Did have a hurricane in the middle of the Atlantic, which for 3 days was the first hurricane to hit the Atlantic at that time of year in like 80 years. We were so unlucky. So we had to...
Because these things happen within a window.
Yeah.
The Talisker Challenge happens in a 3 month window.
Yeah, beginning of December, and there's sort of a week or two that they sort of can delay mm-hmm. the race by. We were already delayed by 2 weeks. And then, yeah, midway through the race, we got a hurricane. The whole fleet had to just batten down the hatches, put out something called power anchor, which is a massive parachute that you put underneath the water, and it sort of holds your position, stops you getting blown back towards Europe or Africa. And that was pretty scary. And to just sit in a hatch for 3 days, it's hot and you're naked and you're just with one other person and you're a bit... It's disgusting. It's really not fun at all. Mm-hmm. And it's annoying because you want to be rowing towards your destination and there's nothing you can do other than just mm-hmm. sit and lie down. So that was probably the hardest bit of the Atlantic.
And that stuff, from what I've heard, more often than not happens actually in those first few days of leaving a continent, right?
It's
you're competing with like say trade winds, big currents, and
the Pacific, specifically. the Pacific, you have big winds and sort of currents pushing you from the north down south. So as you're trying to head west to get to Hawaii, as where, which was our destination, it's pushing you down towards Mexico. So you have this huge side swell and currents, and it's really choppy, which made us all pretty much seasick. People's extremely seasick. So that is really tough. But once you're off the continental plate in your way, then you pick up more of the sort of the steady winds that push you towards Hawaii. But what the difference is of the Pacific with the Atlantic, these subcurrents. So they're all these little sort of almost what feel like back eddies that make you feel like you're rowing in treacle. And even though you've got the wind behind you, you're like, why do I feel like I'm literally rowing in some Marmite right now?
Yeah.
It's these currents, they're just little back eddies. You can't predict when you're going to row into one. So that was really tough. I felt like...
That must be demoralising,
Yeah, you're rowing your heart out and you're going 0.8 knots. And it's just... That was really tough, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Just thinking then, how much does it help in the process of actually rowing somewhere to know you're rowing to Hawaii?
That definitely helped. People are like, oh, why didn't you do the New York to England route? I'm like, because I could be rowing to a tropical island where their pina colada's waiting. Like, that's definitely a motivator.
It's almost like the cycle to John O'Groats Land's End. It feels like you're going downhill in that way. Whereas I bet it must feel like
going,
you're
exactly.
up the other way. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. Rowing into Antigua and Hawaii is something that's vastly different as well. So you're rowing into Antigua. It's a beautiful Caribbean island. It's very tropical and peaceful and calm. Rowing into Waikiki, if anyone's been to Waikiki before, it's like LA on an island in the middle of the Pacific. So the first thing I could smell, because you've just smelt the ocean for you and yourself, which doesn't smell great, for 30 days. And suddenly you see this island, it's got a massive city on it, and I smelt fast food. The first thing I could smell was the fast food coming off that island.
Wow, bizarre.
And then we sort of landed, brought the boat in, we had an amazing welcome by Waikiki Yacht Club, and they put flowers around us and gave us pineapples. And then we had to get to our hotel and straight into a truck onto a freeway. Just can't tell you how scary a freeway is when you haven't seen a car for 35 days.
Wow, okay.
So that was a sort of an assault in the senses. So very different islands to row into, yeah.
Okay. I think I saw a photo actually, and you must have been coming through whatever channel or harbour there was, and there was easily a 6-foot left-hand barreling wave behind you.
That was nuts. That was actually one of the highlights of that row, because Waikiki is meant to be, it's a famous longboarding break, it's meant to be quite gentle.
Yeah.
We came in the biggest swell they'd had all year, and there was 6-foot barreling waves, and what they do to get into the harbour is cut out a channel. It's not that wide, and you have to row through it, but literally 2 metres to your right, you've got somebody surfing. And there were also side winds trying to push you out of that channel. So Mary, who was at the helm at that point, was telling us to row for our lives, just like, come on, girls, you've been rowing for 35 days, you've lost all your muscles, and you're being told to row for your life. You're like, I can't do this. But you have no choice, you get through. And it was actually quite a finish, sort of finished on that real high,
I was surfing at one of the river mouths down here the other day, and there was a fishing, and it was a hefty swell, and there was a fishing vessel coming through. So I can only imagine what that must be like on a on a little...
It was quite cool when the surfers were like, dude, where have you come from? And we were like, San Francisco. And he was like, no way.
Very American.
Yeah.
Very American. Amazing. I mean, it's... God, I mean, there's so much to cover. I mean, there's... one of the things I really wanted to go into was actually some of the philosophies you guys had established going into this, and some of the kind of these guiding kind of principles or what you wanted from the row this time round.
Yeah.
And with any good outfit, you know, we have the same ourselves, and then for 20 years of business, actually, they've guided what we do and kind of keep us on course. And that was this product, environment, people. To this day, probably rings truer than ever, and we always circle back to them. Often forget, but they really kind of affirm what you're doing, and they're a great kind of application for business for us anyway. But you had something very similar yourself with your 3 P's.
Yeah, so we had the 3 P's. We wanted to have a really clear vision for what we were doing and why we were doing it. So we worked with a sustainability consultant to really figure out what we wanted to talk about. At an 18-month campaign, you don't have a lot of time to build up a conversation. So we wanted to find partners that we can do that with, and therefore we wanted to find what our values were, to find the right partners to have the right conversations. So we put ours into these 3 pillars, which is positivity, people, and planet. So this idea of a positive mindset, of just taking everything and saying, I can do this, I will find a solution to this, not being defeated by it, which I think in this day and age, there are a lot of problems, COVID threw out a lot of issues, but actually not saying, I can't do this because of that, but actually saying, right, let's positively approach this and how can we find a solution to get around it? And I think that really feeds into the people pillar, which is when you have the right people around you and the right support, it's much easier to take a positive approach. So how can we as a team, as a group of partners and sponsors, as a community, as our sponsors' communities all come together to have conversations to make change and make better decisions? And then that feeds into the third pillar, which is about the planet. And actually, by having this positive mindset, by doing this all together, we can make better decisions for the planet. And it kind of, how the way that they sort of fed into each other was really important to us and led the conversations that we had throughout our campaign.
Yeah, right. Mm. Yeah, really. Yeah, I mean, they're great reminders as well, probably when you're halfway through something. Okay, yeah. And then, I mean, further to that as well, you spoke last week with us about this clear shared vision for the team, for you four on the boat as well. And yeah. It was that, at last of which was the world record.
Mm.
What were the other ones and how important were they on kind of keeping you on track? And
yeah, so that's the other piece of work we had to do. Because COVID meant that we couldn't be together, we couldn't spend a lot of time getting to know each other. Because even though I'd grown up sailing with Mary and Lily, I didn't know them as adults and how they performed under pressure. Mm. And I'd only met P recently. So we had to do a big piece of work. We worked with Laura Penhall, who had previously rowed across the Pacific, about making sure that we were aligned as a team. And out at sea, when you're under a lot of pressure, but also you are tired, so you're not thinking correctly. Mm-hmm. What can we come up with and make sure that we make the best decisions? So ours was to, one, finish the race healthily and mm-hmm. safely, making sure that we didn't have broken bones, that we all survived it. That is the number one most important thing.
Yep.
The second was to finish better friends than we started. And then thirdly, to get the world record. Because the thing is, if you put the world record first, you might not finish as a team of four. One person might have been lost at sea or broken a leg, and you might hate each other, and therefore you're going to look back on that journey and not like it. You're not going to. Lots of people race across oceans, but they don't. They almost have PTSD from it because they didn't enjoy the experience. And we wanted to enjoy the experience, be better friends, so that it would be a memory that lasts forever. Mm-hmm. And when you put those two things first, actually, consequently, you get the world record. We had it exactly the same on the Atlantic. We did that race as friends, mm-hmm. and we got two world records from it because. When you put it down to a moment, I'm rowing for 2 hours and the other girls want to get off out and get out of bed to let you off the oars because they respect you. They want to give you the break to get you off the oars for 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And when you respect your teammates and you're having fun like that, then you row harder because you're wanting to row harder for your teammates, and therefore the world record comes at the end of it. Mm-hmm. So when we had to make decisions out there, we said, right, what is this going to do? Are we safe making this decision? Yes. Is it a good one for the team and our mentality? Yes. Mm-hmm. Is it going to get us a world record? Yes or no, doesn't matter, but the first two are really important. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, wow. And it worked.
And it worked, yeah, and it did work.
You smashed the world record as well, right? Because Mariah say it was 50 days before that, and you did it in 38?
35 days, 35. Yeah. Yes, we broke the record by just over 2 weeks.
That's a chunk, isn't it?
It is a chunk. I mean, to be honest, not many people have done this route. Only 60 people, 22 teams have ever tried to row from... Mm-hmm. from San Francisco to Hawaii. So
why is that? Is that because it's something like the Talisker overshadows it, or because it's
The Talisker has scaled up the Atlantic and the accessibility of being able to row across the Atlantic. So my dog has just arrived and is now very hyper. And
Koa. Is it of Hawaiian origin?
It is, yeah. Koa means brave or fearless in Hawaiian.
See that as he chews up the corner of the show.
I can't remember what I was saying now.
We were on, this is fine, this is where this is very organic. 35 days. And
yeah,
then
not many people have done it before.
Not many people have done it before.
More people have been to space, have wintered at the South Pole or climbed Mount Everest. So 60 people have been across the Pacific in a rowing boat. I think something
that's
like...
That's nothing, is it?
Yeah, it's nothing, yeah.
And how many people cross it every year in the Talisker?
This year there was something like over 30, 35 teams racing it, which majority are four-man teams. So that one's massively scaled up. Yeah. I think it's not as an accessible route to the Pacific. It is harder. It's not as long as the Atlantic, but it is tougher. But I think as the race develops, the Pacific will get more explored.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
It's almost like that Mount Everest.
Yes, exactly.
In comparison to K2.
Yeah, yeah.
K2
is now...
I think more people die every year on Everest than people of scale K2 or something. That's not accurate information.
Please don't take this for fact. Yeah.
But the okay, really interesting. And actually, quickly back to what you said about the decisions you make on board as a team. How does that work on in a boat of four, where you're making decisions as a unit in comparison to traditionally maritime at sea, where there's a captain?
Yeah, and we did have a skipper.
Okay,
because I think it's really important when you're in a sort of a life crisis situation, somebody needs to call the shots. Mm-hmm. So for us, that was Mary. She's in charge of health and safety. She's in charge of getting us across in one piece. So if there is a situation where we have to call the shots, like for example, we were in some really dangerous waves that were sort of 20-foot waves coming behind us on day 5 or 6, she called the shots to put power anchor out, because even though the waves were going in the right direction, it wasn't safe. There was a chance that we could end up beam onto the waves, we could roll, somebody could go overboard. It's her duty as skipper to make the decision to make sure that we are safe. Mm-hmm. And that's a prime example of where we didn't put the world record first, because we could have made a lot of ground that night. Mm-hmm. But it wouldn't have been safe, and we would have all been terrified. Yeah. And therefore, we might have argued. So that was a classic example of where those values really came into action. But in terms of other sort of decisions on the boat, like I'm a people person. I think I read people quite well. I understand people's emotions, because I am emotional myself. And I think it's okay to be emotional. So I would sort of quite often read the group and say, actually, we need a break, or has everyone had enough water today, or you know, is everyone eating well?
Yeah.
So we all really looked at what skill sets we had, and made sure that my dog's doing very poorly behind me. Made sure that we worked to everyone's sort of skill sets. Mm-hmm. One thing we did is something called this like green light and red light thing, which again was what Laura Penhall told us to do.
Yes, I was going to ask this again. Strengths, weaknesses, identifying these.
They're really important to do. And it's funny, when we sat down, they said, what are your green lights? What are your red lights? And how do you react when a situation happens that brings out one of your red lights? Well, like, how do you respond to that? And how would you like to be treated in that situation? Mm-hmm. So lots of people know what their red lights are. It's really easy to know what your red lights are, because lots of people are, you know, it's easier to say my bad habits, but what people find more difficult is saying actually my green habits are.
Yeah, okay.
So it's a good exercise to do, because you can give people a confidence boost and say, actually, your green lights are that you're really good in this type of situation. Thank you for being like that. Please do more of that. And so it's a really good confidence booster. And then when you learn about people's red lights, it's not just about learning that habit, but actually how they want to be treated when that habit comes out. So for me, when I'm stressed or in a bad situation, I will cry. Like, I will get emotional and I will cry. Mm. What I would like to be treated like in that situation is to be told, it's okay. I know that you're not being sort of weak or anything. It's just that you're having a moment and you'll get through it, and just give me a bit of love. Mary, for example, if she was in a tough situation and she was not enjoying it, and her red habits were coming out, mm-hmm. if you tried to give her a cuddle, she'd probably slap you. And so we figured that out during this conversation, because the rest of us would have wanted to give her a cuddle. Yeah. She would have literally thrown us over the side of the boat. So for Mary, it's about actually taking the piss a little bit, being like, come on, Mary, you're crying again. Yeah. Like, and it was learning how to treat each other that was the real, real game changer for our team.
Yeah. Knowing everyone's responds differently.
Yeah, knowing how people respond and knowing how to then treat them in that situation.
Now, your application of this last week in our big team hoo-ha at the start of the year was applying that to business and in the workplace, and how you treat colleagues or how you might like to be treated yourself. And we've all got our red lights and green lights in the workplace as well, right?
And I think it's exactly that sort of, if you are stressed at work, what are you going to look like? So some people might go really quiet, and actually, if you know that they go really quiet in a stressful situation, maybe that's your sort of sign to say, take them aside and say, are you okay? What can I do to help? Mm-hmm. Or if people are really stressed in a workplace, mm-hmm. they might actually lash out. And it's understanding that they're doing that because they're stressed. So actually, they're not lashing out to be mean. It's understanding that it's something different. How can I change that? Mm-hmm. How can I support them and sort of better the situation? So by learning what good and bad traits people have within an office situation is really, really helpful as a team to then be able to work better.
Okay. We'll follow this up. We'll do a nice broadcast article of Bella's guide to crossing the ocean office. Okay, yeah.
The ocean That's office, cool. yeah, yeah.
Find that in the show notes. Okay, great. I can imagine there are so many crazy stories from a single crossing or moments that you'd say were, you know, just out of this world, or you know, harrowingly scary. But you know, a great question for me to ask in these kind of particularly in these kind of feats is what stands out as your craziest, fondest, most exhilarating or like defining moment of that Pacific race?
Yeah, I think my most exhilarating moment was those 20-foot waves I talked about on about day 5 or 6. So we were barely functioning at this point. I hadn't eaten because I couldn't handle it. I couldn't stomach it. I didn't have the energy to make food. But we were just coming out the other end of that. And it was really tough rowing in these side waves. And then suddenly the waves turned and they were behind us and they were massive. And it's like being on a surfboard and surfing a big wave, but you're in a massive rowing boat. And it's really fun. And that was exhilarating. This sort of like, oh my God, we're surfing these huge waves. We're en route to Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And then it quickly turned into the most scary part of my entire race, which was, this is actually now dangerous. We're losing light. We can't see where the wave's coming from. We can't safely navigate ourselves down them and having that risk of then capsizing. So we put the power anchor out at that time and took ourselves into the cabin for the night. At this point, P was still really seasick, so she wasn't really with it. Mm-hmm. So I had to go into the cabin and curl up next to her in my soaking clothes and just survive the night. And I think that was the only time at sea I've ever been fearful of my life, because I could hear the power anchor on the sort of the bow of the boat just getting tugged under the water, under the power of the waves, and I can hear the waves crashing over the bow and onto the deck, and it just sounded like the boat's going to break in half.
But a lot of faith in that vessel, huh?
A lot of faith, and my uncle actually makes them, so I was like, Charlie, this boat better be all right, yeah.
Well, that's very close to family, it's family.
Yeah. But besides that point, P came around at one point and I said, I am terrified, I'm praying, I'm not religious, but I'm praying right now. And she said, do you have faith in the knots that you've tied, that you've put the power anchor out correctly? And I was like, yeah, I do. And do you have faith that this boat will be in one piece in the morning? I was like, I do. I have full faith that this boat is going to keep me safe. Mm-hmm. Then there's nothing else you can do. You just have to ride it out. And we did.
Because those boats, actually, I heard it somewhere. They do want to stay on top of the water, don't they? They are extremely buoyant. They are strong. Structural rigidity is there. Tried and tested. Mm-hmm. But they're... unlike a big boat, when you see these YouTube clips of a massive tanker out in, you know, the high seas and it peaks and then it slams back down. These boats are very much at one with the wave, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's kind of like a life raft. It's a souped up life raft. Yeah. So at the end, if the cabin doors are closed, which is number two rule of being at sea. So number one rule of being at sea is always being tied to the boat. So if you go over, you're connected. Mm-hmm. And the number two rule is making sure that your cabin doors are closed. Because if you capsize and the cabin doors are open, they'll fill up with water and the boat will remain upside down. Mm-hmm. If the cabin doors are closed, they remain as air pockets that mean that when you capsize, you're going to come back around again.
Yep.
And even if the boat is chopped in two, those two pods will float as two halves.
Okay. And you've got two souped up life rafts.
Exactly. Okay. One's got the navigation in it, one doesn't. Wow. So I know which one I'd be in.
Wow. Okay. I mean, I have incredible respect and kind of infatuation with these big crossings. And then again, mountains, actually. I have a respect for the sea and understand the power of the sea, but the mountain's such a scary, unknown place to me. I'll read books about mountaineering. I'll watch 14 Peaks on Netflix and just be in awe. But there's something about the sea, actually, that I still think, even to this day, and years of being in around it, like, I still can't quite fathom a crossing.
No, we're sea people, we're water people, clearly. I think the mountains to me seem a lot more scary.
Right.
But I do have a huge amount of respect for Mother Nature and the ocean.
Yeah.
And to really see the power of it out there. So only 2 days after we had the scary night of 20-foot waves, it was a mill pond. It was flat as a pancake, bluebird sky, just absolutely insane. And to see the power of the water, how it can go from one extreme to the other in such a short amount of time. Mm-hmm. It's incredible, but you can only see that in the middle of the ocean because the waters around sort of the coastal areas is completely different.
It's a lot more in play, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's those bluebird days when it is flat as a pancake is mind blowing.
Actually leads me on to my next. I was going to ask you were there 35 days at sea, which sounds like a very very long time to be at sea, but actually within that, I imagine that could also fly by almost. But are there moments where you can become complacent or perhaps not be in the moment? Do you look back on that and go, did I take that for granted? Or do you actually, having done one of these before and being with a group of others, do you is it like every day is this most amazing challenge? Or, but yeah, so is there anything that kind of, how do you stay present, I guess?
It's a really good point, because the Atlantic, it is really slow when you're out there. Mm. Every hour feels like 2, 3, 4 hours. Like it's you're rowing for 2 hours and you're like, how's only 2 minutes passed? I'm exhausted. Mm-hmm. But when you're back from a row, time suddenly speeds up really quickly. And that row feels like a different alter ego, a different person than a lifetime ago. And so the Pacific, I really wanted to be more present. I wanted to enjoy that moment, because even though every minute feels like an hour, I knew that when I got back, I wanted to make sure I appreciated my time at sea. So actually something that me, P and Lily did, and this didn't work for Mary, again, it's understanding your teammates. This didn't work for Mary because she's not an emotive person. But for me, Lily and P, we did a daily gratitude. Every day, the first shift when the sun came out up, what were you grateful for today? Because it put you back in that moment to be like, we've got to enjoy every second of this, because we're privileged to be in this position. We're privileged to see this part of the world. Let's make sure that we're grateful for it. And actually, by doing those gratitudes every day, you can't say every day the same things. It really makes you think about other things that you are grateful for. So it could be something like, I'm really grateful that you put that song on yesterday because it really lifted my spirits. Mm-hmm. Or it could be, I'm really grateful that P made me a cup of tea, because it meant actually I got 10 minutes of extra sleep because P made me that tea that I could drink it as I came off my shift.
Yeah.
Or I'm really grateful for the fact the sun came out today, or that bird visited us. And it really, really puts you into this, into the moment, and making sure you do appreciate it. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. That Nutrigain was insane.
yeah, exactly. It was like, oh, I found a chocolate on bar in my snack pack today. It was amazing. Yeah.
Pretty sure someone bought me a gratitude journal for Christmas. So I'll start with that and then progress to the crossing.
Yeah.
now this whole challenge was by no means this. I actually haven't asked you, but it's, you know, like you said, it was something that you, personal development or the next kind of the move on from your Atlantic crossing. But you also did this to raise awareness of a few other issues or money and help towards, and that was the Seabin project.
What is
the Seabin project?
So the Seabin project, they're an Australian organization that are trying to clean up our oceans, starting with marinas and ports and sort of coastal habitats. So they put these big bins into marinas and ports that suck up plastics, microplastics, oils, anything that really is debris that shouldn't end up in the ocean. And what is really interesting is they're not just being reactive to the situation. They are actually being proactive by saying, what is ending up in these bins? Where is it coming from, and how can we prevent it getting there in the first place? Mm-hmm. So they've just launched a really successful pilot scheme in Sydney, because I think what they realised before is that just having one bin isn't enough. You need to understand the whole sort of ecosystem of a city and connect it all and influence a whole city as one. So they're trying to do this sort of new scaling thing where they approach a whole city at once. So they've just done Sydney. They've actually announced last week that they're doing a pilot scheme in LA.
Yeah.
Which is really exciting. And what we're trying to raise money for is the London sort of pilot scheme.
Yeah.
So how can we sort of raise the education of, or raise awareness of the issue, why plastic in our oceans is bad, or how that's affecting our marine habitats, and how can we stop it getting there and sort of introduce that into London.
So London and the Thames is a great, great starting point, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Did I read somewhere there was something that's been tried in Falmouth, is one in Falmouth?
Coincidentally, a guy called the Paddlelogger, he's got an Instagram handle, reached out, and he's him and his sort of followers have raised money for a Seabin in Falmouth Harbour, which is brilliant. I think they'll try and sort of raise money to put some more in. But it's great to see something here sort of on our own turf, trying to take plastic waste out of the marinas. Yeah.
Yeah. So by no means a self-fulfilling crossing, this actually had a bit more kind of purpose or depth to it as well. And it's,
and I think there's been a couple of situations where I've seen the effects of sort of debris in the ocean. So I saw it in the Atlantic. We saw more wildlife in the Pacific, sorry, more plastic in the Pacific than wildlife.
Yeah,
wow. We barely saw any wildlife on that crossing. But what really changed my sort of mindset on how big this plastic problem is when I went to Haiti a couple of years ago. My mum used to live and work there. And their streets and canals and rivers are absolutely chock-a-block with waste.
Yeah.
They're a country that's been sort of made reliant on importing Western goods wrapped in plastic, don't have the infrastructure to know how to recycle it and clear it away. We're probably the same as a sort of a country, you know, us first world countries. we don't know how to get rid of it either. We just are really good at cleaning our streets. Mm-hmm. But in Haiti, they couldn't do that. And to me, it really made me appreciate the size of the problem and maybe want to, one, row an ocean to highlight the awareness of that, mm-hmm. but also work for a company that's trying to make a difference too. And that's mm-hmm. how I ended up down here in Cornwall and working for FlexiHex, who are trying to remove plastic from the packaging industry or, yeah, just trying to make the packaging industry better, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask that, actually. I was going to ask that a little bit later to the end, but as you mentioned it, so FlexiHex, I know through Sam and...
Will.
Say again?
Will.
Thank you. Yeah. There you go, sorry.
Sorry, Will.
and, you know, along with yourself and that crew, you know, kind of daring creatives, really, and those boys always have been, haven't they? And
it's, yeah.
But, you know, you're quite literally taking on the packaging industry. And I know it started off with the concept of looking after and protecting a surfboard in transit.
Yeah.
And I think I've tried one out and they're bulletproof, aren't they?
They are bulletproof. And I think that where we've transitioned is into protecting bottles.
Exactly, yeah.
But you can drop a sort of a full bottle of Prosecco from a two-story building and it won't smash and it's just paper. It's just very clever designs.
Corrugated kind of...
Honeycomb mesh that sort of
not
expands.
Not corrugated.
Yeah, not corrugated, honeycomb. Okay. That sort of expands and contracts around objects.
Yeah.
And it's a really simple design. I think that's what Sam and Will are sort of... Their approach is about being simple, but being clever with it.
Yeah.
I'm really excited to work for a company that's just thinking about things a bit differently.
And that said, and I know that the team there were very... When you started working for them, they knew that you had... the Pacific race in mind, and you were going in quite open about that.
Yeah.
How has it been returning to life as normal? How is it after something like this? Is it a relief? Is it a...
When I came back from the Atlantic, I pretty much was a zombie for 6 months. Mm. I couldn't understand the person that I was anymore after doing something that monumental to go back to my 9-to-5 in London. And I wasn't a London person, but I didn't know that at the time. I actually have a bit of memory loss from that period of my life. But coming back from this row, I was so excited. Like middle way through the Pacific, I was emailing FlexiHex saying, you know, what's our sales at the moment? How many people have we got on board? Like I was so excited to come back to join them because I'm so passionate about what they're doing. Right. But I was also passionate about coming back to Cornwall because I found somewhere that I love living in. And I get out every day and I walk along the beach or I, you know, go out for paddleboard and I'm it gets me out of bed in the morning. I'm so excited.
Yeah.
So I was really looking forward to coming back and it made me want to row faster, to be honest.
Yeah, okay. Good. Well, there you go, yeah. My understanding with... Back to the row again. We'll keep hopping back and forth. But my understanding is that, you know, as granted, as like these things require a tremendous amount of grit and graft. But at the same time, I see... It can very much be something, an extraordinary thing that an ordinary person can do.
Mm.
Is that fair in saying?
Definitely fair in saying. And I would like to be an approachable person that inspires people who think they can't achieve things to set their heights sights higher. I think when my early 20s was approached to row the Atlantic, I didn't know how to row. I actually got on a rowing boat and rowed backwards the first time because I didn't know which way to put the oars into the water. I wasn't an adventurer. I was nicknamed Lisa Simpson by my brothers. I'm a geek. I was a scholar at my school. You know, like I'm not an adventurer, but
we certainly are now. Yeah.
Maybe I am now, but I think that I had a bit of belief in myself, and I had the right, again putting it back to the people. I had the right people around me to give me confidence to say we think you can do this, and I wanted to prove to them and to myself that anybody is capable of achieving something like this. If you just say yes. And it's that saying yes, it's always the hardest part. Because once you said yes, the balls start rolling and they get bigger and bigger. And you find that if you just take one step at a time, you've got to that start line. Mm-hmm. Just say yes and see how it goes and break it down into chunks. But that's how I've approached life. It's how I've approached everything. And I think the other thing that I've always done is being open to opportunity. Johnny Wilkinson mentions it in another podcast I listened to, that he sees every day as an opportunity, whether it's doing the washing up or having a conversation with someone you never met before, but always look for what might be around the corner while still being present, but it's not getting stuck in your ways and just seeing where life takes you.
Yeah.
And I think I always do that. I always sort of see everything as an opportunity.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, amazing. And yeah, kind of following on from that, like I mentioned earlier, my man crush on Pete Goss, MBE. Such a dude.
Such a dude.
But is there anybody, and again, we talked about ordinary people there, but is there anybody who stands out as a big inspiration for you with these things, or a group of people? Because obviously you've done this as a group before, and I think there's that camaraderie and group effort actually is... we so often separate people as individuals, don't we?
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people that inspire me, from my brother to Johnny Wilkinson, who's my all-time hero, and actually left me a video last summer that I cried about and snorted. And
really?
Yeah, oh my God, I was beside myself. but I think that the magic of ocean rowing is anybody can do it. So you've got... when in the Atlantic race that I did, we had a group of mums from Yorkshire, the Yorkshire mums, and they were in their sort of 50s, and they sort of took it on. Doesn't matter if we're mums or we're in our 50s.
They're Yorkshire mums. That's it. I've got a Yorkshire mother, and they're a different breed.
They were a different breed. I hope they listen to this. I mean that in a good way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, they're brilliant. So, you know, it took them on. They had a group of Antiguans, and one of them, I think, was in his 70s. He's the oldest man to ever row across the Atlantic. Down to, there was an army team, and they had three legs in the team of four men. So one guy had no legs, the other three had one leg each. Okay. Then you had us girls. We were in our early 20s, probably going into it a bit naively, but with a sort of a gung-ho spirit. Down to a group of Americans who thought they were the best rowers because they, you know, were sort of almost Olympic athlete rowers, but had no ocean experience. And I think the race is humbling because it puts everybody in the same boat, literally. Mm-hmm. You can come from any background and you put in the same race and you compete. And therefore, they are all heroes to me because it puts you all on the same start line, basically. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Wow.
I think that is it. Was one of the things that made me want to do another ocean is because you meet people from all walks of life that inspire you, that make you believe that actually maybe I can achieve different things in my career, in my personal life, whatever they might be. But when you open your eyes to different communities and things like an ocean race, or maybe you join a surf club, but when you join, it can be anything, but join things, talk to different people, because it will dramatically sort of affect and shape your life. Yeah.
Yeah. I do love those stories of people that are actually like ordinary, or a few guys I know who several years ago now, they did the UK circumnavigation.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think you row out of the Thames estuary. And then I don't know how long it took, I forget how long it takes, but they were a ragtag group of boys, actually from Essex and Mersey Island.
Mersey, I know them, yeah. One of them was the ex-boyfriend of the girl that I rode the Atlantic with.
Oh, really? Okay. I think no one thought in a million years. They went and won it.
Yeah, they got a record, the world record for the fastest time, yeah.
Yeah. And I think the story was, because I think they followed out, what's the Queen's, what's the royal boat, the big golden thing that rides down the Thames? I think they follow that to the Thames Barrier or something.
Right, okay.
And then they can go.
Right.
And I think they'd questioned as to why do we have to follow once we're off? Can't we just overtake that? Like, oh, you won't overtake that. It goes at certain amount of knots or whatever.
And
they
did.
And then the second they're allowed to, they just shot past it. And I don't think, like yourselves, like 2 hours on, 2 hours. But they've just,
yeah.
I think Josh told me that they were that determined to do this thing. I don't think they once like splashed their face with water or some anecdote like that. It was just like hell for leather, however long. And
rowing around Great Britain is actually much harder. Because the tides around Britain and the currents caused by the different depths of the ocean, I guess, or our seas, it's really tough. My brother's gone around Great Britain, and there are times that you actually can't row 2 hours on, 2 hours off, because you physically cannot row against those tides. So when you do have to row, when the tides are with you, you could be rowing for 6 hours straight because you've got to make the most of it. Yeah, it's a tough old one going around Great Britain, yeah.
Yeah, wow. Another thing, actually, I wanted to ask about, and kind of an add-on again is what we just talked about, but what in that row that you've just done last year are you now applying to your life back home or professional life? And you spoke at the Blue Earth Summit back in October, for example. So is this like personal development? Is it adding to that? Have you got...
Yeah, it's definitely helped me progress my professional career, which I think a lot of people wouldn't put them hand in hand. When Lily was deciding whether she's going to join our team or not, she said, "Well, I'm trying to progress my career. I don't think it's going to help." And I said, "Actually, I think it's quite the opposite. I think it will help, and it'll make you stand out in a crowd." it has pushed me personally because I have been asked to do talks and join podcasts. It's not something I feel naturally comfortable doing, but I've had to step out of my comfort zone to do that and learn how to communicate my story and make it approachable. And I'm sort of a better all-rounded person for that and a better leader for that, which is what I'd love to be, sort of a leader in a business setting at some point. So it has definitely taught me to do that. I'm a marketer. So throughout my campaign for The Row, I had to learn how to do Instagram lives, how to interview people, how to grow a following rapidly, build a website, a brand. And all of that has given me the confidence to implement it into FlexiHex. And I built a lot of relationships with our sponsors, from Finisterre to Dame, Sweaty Betty. You know, we had some really great sponsors that I've got inspiration from them and the way they do things and connections within people in similar roles that I can now lean on and bring into FlexiHex. So there's definitely things that I sort of bought across. And I think the final one would probably be that teamwork of, I had to learn how to manage a team in a really extreme environment. Now, your office isn't an extreme environment, but there are definitely the skills I talked about earlier of trying to understand people and realizing that we're not all perfect. So let's sort of figure each other out a bit better. That means that I can better be a leader, manage my team, and have a sort of a better day-to-day life. Actually, I said that was the final one, but my fourth final thing is that gratitude thing. I don't do it every day, but I try to do it a few times a week, just to sit down and appreciate what's around you, especially living down here in Cornwall. It's easy to forget how like lucky we are living in such a beautiful place like this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's a good time of year to think all those as well, as people talk resolutions or routines and stuff.
Yeah. And I think that's another sort of another thing is that when it comes to resolutions and routines, don't worry about where you start. Just be consistent. It's sort of probably another message I want to put out there. When I first started training for this specific race, I couldn't sit on a rowing machine for more than 10 minutes. I would be huffing and puffing and I hated it. I hated a Concept 2 rowing machine. But I got myself a trainer. I set some goals. I was consistent. I wasn't perfect at it. I didn't give up my entire life just to sit on a rowing machine, but I just ticked away at it. And by 6 months after I first started, I rode a marathon for 3.5 hours on a rowing machine. So it was just about that perseverance that means you can sort of reach your goals. So don't be afraid of where you started. Just, again, say yes, go for it, and just be consistent.
Yeah, right. And what's your relationship with the ocean like now? Does that change every time after this? How does that evolve?
I need the ocean. I need the water in my day every single day I need it. And I didn't realise that after the Atlantic. And I think that's why I was so blue, excuse the term, but I was blue when I went back to London. I then moved to California. I had a career in California for 4 years. And living by the sea, having done an Atlantic crossing, I realised that is what made me happy. So when I moved back to the UK and I was trying to decide what to do with my life, I came back in the middle of the pandemic. I had no career. I didn't know what I was going to do or where I was going to live, but I knew that I needed the sea in it. So how could I form a life around that? And hence why I ended up in Cornwall. But yeah, I try and sort of get on it, in it, near it at some point every single day.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good thing to live by. Now I've come to realize that this is the hardest question to ask now, because once you've done 45 minutes of talking about it, to go, what was your hell or high water moment? But is there a moment in that crossing, either crossing or even in the build up to it, or where you've gone, come hell or high water, we'll see this through?
I think that final hurdle of you can't get into America. Really? Oh my God. And our boat wasn't getting in there. We couldn't get it through customs. And we're like, this is make or break. Like, we could have been working here for 18 months and we're not going to get there because I can't get through security and all the rules that government's put in place. But we were, as a team, like, come a hell or high water, we are going to make this happen.
Yeah.
And so we fought our way through customs. We found a solution to get through, the border control and things like that, because we were so determined. And it was that, again, it's that solution finding thing of not being defeated. We were not going to get defeated. We were getting to that start line.
Yeah.
I think a lot of people had given up on us and a lot of people didn't think it was going to happen, but we were never defeated by that.
Yeah. Mm. Kudos. Have you watched that 14 Peaks on Netflix?
I have. Yeah.
Because the Nims, the guy, right? Yeah. It was the final mountain in China, or the second to last. And it was the final one, wasn't it? And the Chinese government had closed the mountain for the year again. It hadn't been open for a few years for climbing. And through social media hype and all this and letters and a political approach and meeting with, you know, heads of state or whatever, they manage to get it over. So, yeah.
When there's a will, there's a way. There's a I definitely learned that from P. I would say normally I would say ask once and give up. P's like, ask three times. Always ask people three times, because if they're saying no on the third time, they really mean it. But if they're saying like no after the first time, they might not mean it. Mm-hmm. So I actually take that quite a lot into sort of my my day-to-day as well, as ask three times. They're still saying no. Okay, fair enough. Maybe take it. Yeah. But she's given me that perseverance to not give up. And she was the one that really drove us through. We're going to get into America, and our boat's getting into America. Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
Wow. Yeah. It sounds like FlexiHex have got someone good on their team who's going to
FlexiHex is going to make
take
it.
Over
yeah.
The packaging world. Amazing. Yeah. Okay. All the three. Amazing. So, and besides, aside from work, actually, what's next? Have you got anything that you and the other girls are talking about, or is there
a separate
solo thing in mind, or?
Right now, I'm really happy, like, just settling into my life here in Cornwall. Just got a puppy, you know, need to give her all the attention.
She's been very well behaved for the last half an hour.
Finally falling asleep, yeah. But I think P and I like little micro adventures. We love paddleboarding, so she's coming down in a couple of weekends' time, and we might think up a sort of a little micro adventure here in the UK on our paddleboards. One day, I'd love to sail across an ocean. Mm-hmm. Probably sail it with a crew first. Maybe one day do it alone, mm-hmm. but.
See, I really want to do. I think I've got an anchor tattoo. Apparently, you need to have crossed an ocean to have earned one.
So. Oh gosh, right! You need to get that off.
Right, but I imagine there's a few more people who've got these. Yeah, but I need to earn that. So.
Yeah, you either earn it or you need to go get laser.
Yeah,
off.
Laser yeah. off. Shit. Okay.
No, I think sailing across. I'd like to have that experience of being in the middle of an ocean without having to get up at 2 a.m. and row for 2 hours. That would be quite nice.
Okay. Amazing. Hey, thanks so much for coming back in 2 weeks on the trot.
No worries, I like it. I think really Sam cool. and Will are sort of thinking that I might be leaving FlexiHex and joining Finisterre at this point.
Yeah, okay, we're going to start any rumours. We plug FlexiHex enough, that's good.
Yeah.
I think we stock it on our web shop, if I'm not mistaken. So
awesome.
There you go. Hey, thanks so much, Bella.
No, cool. Thanks for having me in.
Cheers. Well, I hope you enjoyed that one. Bella's certainly someone with a refreshing outlook on life, adventure and challenge. Also someone, having only met her a couple of times myself, has a great rapport with people, something I imagine would be very helpful if spending a month plus at sea with someone. I don't think we've seen the last of Bella in the ocean space. With folk of this persuasion and competitiveness, whether they know it or not, always subconsciously planning for the next challenge. You can see some of the incredible imagery we spoke about and all other links and content over in the show notes, finisterre.com/hellorhighwater. Thanks again to Bella. Congrats again to the whole Ocean Sheroes team. Thanks to Gareth at Chatterbox Audio for helping us put the show together. Sound design by CJ Mirror. If you are listening via the usual podcast platforms, subscribe to be the first to know about future episodes. And we will see you next time.